earlier today visiting some people in the federal government to talk to them about some of the very issues that I'm going to share with you this afternoon and make some recommendations. The next few slides are excerpts from a report that we released earlier this month on May 3rd. The report is titled "Use It or Lose It: Industry Solutions to Ontario's Commercialization Gap." And it is the summary of results of a survey that we conducted with 135 industry representatives. This is the breakdown of the representation of the respondents to this survey. It's also a pretty good reflection of the breakdown of Ontario's industry in the health science technology space, with the majority of the companies in Ontario being in the medical device space, 36%, 24% therapeutics, diagnostic at 11%, and at the time we did the survey, which was in November of 2017, we were breaking out health IT and digital, but combined their 12% of the survey respondents. And we are always, as an organization, we're always thinking forward, we're always thinking about how do we build anchor companies, what do we need to do as an organization in terms of policy, recommendation, program delivery that will help us deliver on our vision of a robust health science industry. And the challenge that we have about around building anchor companies, sticky companies, companies that will stay here and grow here. So one of the themes in our work at the time we conducted this survey is what are the barriers to scaling up? We are, as an organization, we're funded by both the federal and the provincial government to do our work. And one of the themes that we talk a lot with government about is the challenge of companies and this whole jargon around build them and flip them, and how do we actually create an ecosystem where companies will stay here and grow here. So we're trying to understand that at a ecosystem and a cultural, fairly granular level when you think about tax policy and so on and other incentives for companies and for investors to leave companies here. So number one barrier identified by industry in this particular survey was supportive local infrastructure at 38%. This is the first time industry has identified this as their number one priority, and it reflects the maturation of industry. That they're thinking about infrastructure as a priority, and still very close to access to capital, but their number one priority for the first time in this work was support of local infrastructure, which roughly translates to access to markets. Number two was access to capital and local tax incentives, and we've done a lot of work in this area. Two of the programs that we deliver are very focused on access to capital. And with respect to local tax incentives, we've done a lot of, we released a policy paper last year on tax policy recommendations around some of the regulatory hurdles that were discussed in the last panel, as well as SHRED and changes to SHRED that would create incentives for companies and investors to do more of the R&D here. Talent, and for from our work, talent is both entry-level, mid-level, as well as C-suite, but the part of the talent gap that we've been focused on is the entry and mid-level, as well as the challenge of building anchor companies was identified as a barrier. So we never ask industry what the problem is without asking them what the solution is. So the top five solutions, there were about 10 that they proposed, were establishing a health innovation capital fund. So now that they're focused on solutions, now capital comes to number one. Number two, work with industry to establish a network of early adopter institutions to invest in infrastructure and programming to pilot new drugs and technologies in Ontario. I think this is a tremendous competitive advantage for Ontario if we can do this. Number three, consolidate government funding programs and bring application review processes into line with standard market terms and global investment practices. This was a topic that I discussed this morning on Queen Street, and discuss a fair bit in Ontario on Bay Street. Number four, procurement processes, and number five, tax policy to attract investment and help companies grow. So looking at some of these solutions at a more granular level, so industry solution two was sort of the whole concept of early adopter institutions, and we call this access to markets, investing in infrastructure programming so that companies can pilot, vet, have technologies evaluated, scaled, procured, adopted. So the question was, how important is it to get local Ontario hospitals and health service providers to use your technology as a means of showcasing it? 50% of the respondents said it's critical or important. And as we go through the next few slides, you'll see the relationship between that response between and how many of the companies in Ontario have actually been able to access our Ontario institutions. So another question along the lines of trying to solve this dilemma and work towards a solution as posed by industry. What are the typical reasons for your company to engage with Ontario hospitals or health service providers? So number one, piloting, engaging the expertise. This is a real opportunity for us in Ontario to develop KOLs, key opinion leaders, and if we can focus on developing them here, I believe from our work that this is a key element in being able to keep technologies here. Becoming a vendor of technology solution to the end user or hospital, understanding specific challenges. Surprised that this was fourth on the list. Understanding specific challenges of the end user so that our company can develop technology solutions. The list goes down from there. You can read the whole report if you want to read the whole list. Interestingly, we asked, has your company ever conducted a clinical trial or pilot of your technology at an Ontario hospital or research institution? We know from the companies that we work with that they are looking to the U.S. to conduct their clinical trials. So this was a really important question for us to understand. 43% of the companies that responded to the survey said yes. They're sort of spread across diagnostic device, drug, digital, and health IT. We didn't in this work drive down to the next level of detail on those that responded no, so I can't tell you why they responded no, but of the 43% that answered yes, we did ask some more questions of them that are also detailed in the report. So thinking about this whole question of building anchor companies and giving companies a reason to stay here and grow here, we asked the question, if there was a network of early adopter hospitals and a receptive ecosystem in Ontario, would your company stay here and grow here? And 96% of the respondents said yes. So that was not a surprise for us, that it was, such a high percentage of respondents was sort of confirmatory for us that we need to solve this this challenge and work towards a solution. Shifting gears now to the industry solution three, which was around consolidating government funding programs and bringing application review process into line, standard market terms and global investment practices. We hear all the time from early stage companies that they have to go to 10 different programs to get $100,000, and everybody wants to do their own due diligence and everybody has their own application process, and it's almost an FTE just to apply for all this money. So as we asked this question, we looked at where are they getting their money federally and provincially, and what kinds of programs are they getting their money from. Simplifying the procurement process was one of the solutions that they presented as well. And the biggest challenge here, the biggest message here, is that companies don't know where to start when they're trying to engage with a hospital. And they almost don't know which door to go through. So we've actually, since we've started to analyze this data, we've done some more work on this response so that we can, as we are working with companies, help them understand how to more efficiently engage with the hospital system. For this slide, I combined one and two. One is the Health Innovation Capital Fund. Companies are always looking for money. And then adopting a globally competitive tax policy to attract investment and help grow companies. They're surprisingly related because companies, as they attract money, they're always looking for money that's going to help them extend runway, and they're always looking to attract capital. And so our ability to attract capital and then keep it here with competitive tax policies are really key considerations if we're going to incentivize investors to leave the company here and make it worth their while to continue to do R&D here. So that is the overview that I would like to leave you with from our perspective on the kind of work that we're doing on how we create an industry that can survive for the next 20 years and bring their technologies to you and to other Canadians to help make us all healthier. And I am just going to find the exit here. And let the next person have a few minutes. Whoops, I screwed it up already.
It's very small.
All right. I'll take your. Sal, do you want the clicker? And Sal, do you want to say a few words about yourself before you start?
So I'm from IBM Services, and my background is from about 2000 to 2007 life sciences. I worked at biopharmaceuticals and genetic proteomic companies. It was a lot of fun in startups all over the place, all over the world. Then I moved into healthcare, and my life really slowed down, and it's been quite a venture in healthcare. But it's great combining the two skills, so I was asked to what's the next 20 years, and what are the technologies that will impact life sciences. And I apologize, I can't.
Do you
my
want
eyes
to
are getting old or something.
Why
I can't
don't
see
you
that
just screen. Switch seats?
No, it's okay. I can do it from here.
Sure.
So I'm asked to give you what's the impact of various technologies, and I was also told I only got 10 minutes, so there's 30 minutes worth of slides, so I'm really going to speed this up for you. What I'll start off by saying is you'll see more changes in the next 10 years than you have in the last 300. I'll guarantee that. Okay, you're talking to a guy who in 1982 I was a co-op at Waterloo at IBM from the University of Waterloo, and I supported the engineers in South America, so I was instinct messaging them back and forth. And I convinced one of my colleagues that he should, get to know this lady in Peru, and he ended up marrying her. So I was the first guy to do online dating, right? In 1991, I did this ping and pong. I got this digital back computer to talk to an IBM computer. I had to do some microcoding to make that happen. And I said to somebody, this internet thing might take off. And that was in 1991. I can tell you there's about five technologies that are bigger than all those coming in. I'm not going to cover off quantum computing. Maybe in the next couple of years we'll do that. But what I wanted, so I'm, John asked me to talk about disruptive forces, so I will do that. And let me just get into it because I only got 10 minutes. I'm going to talk about these different areas, but the first one is this demographic tsunami. Let's just take Ontario, because we're here. In 2025, the baby boomers will hit the healthcare system, and they will hit it hard in many different ways. If you just wanted to keep the same level of care that we have today, In 2025, you would have to double the number of hospitals, number of caregivers, number of doctors, number of specialists, number of labs to meet the same level of care, which we're not happy about. 50 cents, or 50 cents of every dollar the Ontario government spends is on health care. 10 years ago, it used to be 35%. And it's still rising at a meter, you know, very quick rate. That tsunami is going to hit. It starts around 2025 and really peaks out around 2030, 33, 5 time frame. At the same time, there are technologies coming along in 23andMe that you can get your genetic profile done for $100. Your full profile. So you get it, what do you do with it? Well, as one oncologist told me recently, she had a patient who knew more about her cancer than she did. And she was always afraid of talking to this patient because she couldn't keep up. Because in healthcare, it's all about knowledge. And life science is about creating stuff. In healthcare, it's about knowledge. Well, you and I can look up that knowledge. You know, I mean, if you have a cancer, guess what? There's no limit in the databases you can get to. I can give you those databases. So we have a number of disruptive forces. We have emerging consequences, of course. You know, the healthcare system, part of it will be privatized, I think, over time. Right? Because you can do it more efficiently. You'll still be paid by the Ontario government. Doesn't mean the Ontario government's not going to pay. They'll pay, but they have no choice. They're running out of money. So there'll be, you know, emerging consequences, pressing challenges. This is not just an industry change. This is an economic change, right? So sometimes I work with entrepreneurs and there's a certain set of profiles you look for and all that. I could throw away all those rules now. Those do not apply in the new world. So a lot of this knowledge and stuff in terms of startups or businesses that you applied 5 years ago will not apply 3 years from now. I'll guarantee that. Right? Provocative forces. So let's get into this. I'm going to skip over some of this and just get into the various technologies, because that's what I want to cover off before within the 10 minutes. Consumerism. That's, you know, I work, one of the areas that I cover off is mobility. That's really consumerism. You know, I applaud the province of Quebec. By the end of this year, people in the province of Quebec can see their own patient records, which is great. At the same time, you know, they'll see their own lab tests, they'll see what their own doctors write about them, which will be interesting to see that, of course, right? But they themselves can then take that information and go off elsewhere on the internet and figure out how they can help themselves. A year after that, they're going to know the costs. They're going to know the cost of a visit to a doctor for this, or a cost to the emergency department for that, and suddenly they're going to start to compare those costs. And baby boomers are terrible, because they will do that. They will compare the cost. They will compare the service. They will say, I only went to see the doctor and it gave me 6 minutes and it cost $150. I'm not sure if I like that. I thought I'd get $420. Because what is the difference in performance, pay of a doctor, the highest performance and lowest? In pay, it's nothing. Right? So in Denmark, we've seen this, because we implemented this 12 years ago. In Denmark, patients can see their own health records. Patients can select their own doctors. Patients can select who sees their health records. And guess what? They're the only Western nation where healthcare costs have gone down. They had 90 major hospitals and clinics and now have only 67. And they're the healthiest population in Northern Europe. Right? And that was the biggest impact. They actually have forms where they rate doctors. You move from the city of Toronto to Ottawa, you have to be a 23-year-old, you're pregnant, or you have diabetes, you can find other people in your same situation, same profile, same background, and they'll give you a set of doctors that have specialized in that. They've had that for over 12 years, and it's giving them a huge significant benefit. So that's all coming. You know, incumbent organizations, yeah, we're under attack, right? We, IBM, for instance, we have to change. If we don't change, we won't be here. I've been in company, in IBM for 33 years. I've seen 5 transformations. This is one of the tougher ones. In June of 91, people don't realize, technically, they were bankrupt. That was the easiest transformation. Because there was no question, we had to figure out what we were gonna do. We were technically bankrupt. We didn't even know if we were gonna make payroll. When you're at that level, it's kind of easy to figure out what your next steps are, right? So those changes are coming. Data must deliver meaningful insights. This is really important. If you're not doing analytics as part of your product development, I get invited, like on July 7th, I'm gonna go to Baycrest to see 100 and so companies, right? The VCs always come up to me and say, you know, Sasha, we invested that or this or that. And one of the things, criteria I look at now is, are they doing any analytics? Is there any feedback to their product loop? How do they know the product is effective or can be better? They're not doing it. And by the way, it doesn't cost a lot. You can get on, you get Watson Analytics for $200 a month. You sign on, get on to Watson, for $200 a month, you can do the basic analytics.
Or free if you're an academic.
Or free if you're an academic, sorry. I have Colette, who's our client executive for higher ed and director here, and they're free for academics. So there's no reason why you can't just go ahead and use them. People must be digitally empowered. Well, that's happening. I mean, my wife is digitally empowered. She knows how to do online shopping, which drives me crazy. But Amazon has been wiping out their competition because of not Amazon, because of their customers. They're digitally empowered. It's not Amazon wiping out Target or Sears that went under here. It's their clients that's taking them out, right? They're providing a better service and it's online, right? For instance, in Denmark, they book doctor's appointments online. They book specialist appointments online. They can change them within 24 hours. Been doing it for a dozen years. They look at us and when I tell them I had to make 3 different phone calls to book an appointment with my doctor, they're like looking at me like, why would you ever do that? So, let's talk about some of the technologies that are really going to hit. I'll start off with this one. I'm not going to cover them all. We released recently Watson for diagnostic imaging. Now, in Ontario, the average radiologist spends how much time do you think on your x-ray? 27 seconds. And you get your diagnosis, they get $75. Okay? Roughly speaking, right? So, and there is an error rate. My wife went through that recently, about a year ago. You know, we thought she had lung cancer, right? The x-ray came back, looks like it, right? So, you know, your life starts to change when you start to think about what happens after that. But then I started asking some questions. So many questions, there was incongruent information here. It wasn't her x-ray, it was somebody else's. Only to discover radiologists tell me, yeah, the error rate's around 20%. You caught it. I felt great, elated, but I felt sorry for somebody else who doesn't know that they need to really get media's attention. And I don't know when that person's gonna find out. I have no clue. I don't know who that patient is. Watson Diagnostic Imaging, the way it works is the following. Yes, it looks at your x-ray. It'll look at your medical history to try to help to do the diagnosis. It'll look at the electronic health record, which is unstructured data. It's just notes from the doctor. It'll look at that. It might say, oh, nausea. I wonder if that's related. It'll look up papers that might relate this image to nausea. It'll look up your family history. Right? It'll look at other lab tests. It'll look at weight changes. If you had other x-rays, it's going to do a comparative. It'll look at your background, phenotypic data. It'll look at literally 800 million pages of information. It'll do that in 0.85 seconds. It's now in 6 sites around the world. But I can tell you the third part in one of the earlier charts is, what is the biggest challenge to any of these technologies? Resistance. Because last year, the average radiologist made $600,000 here in the province of Ontario. With this technology, his income would be half. I've yet to find anybody in any industry to put up their hand and say, yeah, I'm gonna make half the money I wanted, did last year. You're gonna provide a higher level of safety, because Watson right now, in those six validated sites, is operating less than 2% error rate, and it kicks out those things where it thinks it's wrong. And it'll tell you, I don't feel comfortable with this, so you gotta figure it out, right? And it'll give the information, it'll tell you the source of information, it'll tell you how it decided, what it is, it'll give you a quick summary. It could also give you a long-term summary. You can change the sources of information. If you don't like PubMed and you'd rather have Cleveland Clinic or something else, you can do that, right? And it'll do that in 0.85 seconds with incredible accuracy and information. I explained it to my GP said, well, why would I need a radiologist? My patients don't even see a radiologist. I'm the one who has to, at the end of the day, give them the final, you know, answer diagnosis. Right? That's here, right? Blockchain. We have no less than 500 proof of concepts for blockchain around the world. And about 100 of them will go into production in the first half of next year. There's one in pharmaceutical. We track a batch, the primary chemical elements coming from China and India, the receive it facility. In the blockchain, you actually write down who was there to receive it, what day, where was it stored to meet GMP requirements, good manufacturing process as defined by 21 CFR Part 11 of the FDA Act. I've seen it where the FDA came into Canada and shut down a manufacturing facility because it did not meet GMP. They got 411, 412, and 512 warnings, and they shut down the plant in Canada, because they were supplying to the US. Well, in blockchain, you can put that all into the blockchain. And you can demonstrate self-auditing in real time for every single batch versus just, you know, once in a while checking for that batch. And that's being built. You can add actors and take away actors. Actors being suppliers. If you have a bad actor, you take them out and replace them. You can do that in blockchain, you just keep going. You get to the other end, you finally get the batch, you get the bottles, you know where the bottles are going and which pharmaceuticals. And then as it's getting dispensed, you know which pharmacist dispensed to what patient. So when you do a recall, you know exactly where to go. That's being built. And because you built that blockchain, you can add companies, you can start personalizing medicine. Once you built that blockchain, you can do a lot of things. That's being built. There's one for food supply. How many times have we been hit by E. coli virus? But we don't know which farm, right? That's being taken care of too. We're DNAing all the way back to the farms, to the animals. So that's being built. That blockchain is being built. Internet of Things. So I'm working on the Internet of Things to keep people at home. My vision is I can take a 300 bed hospital, make it 20,000 beds. Because one of the reasons you keep a person in a hospital is because you gotta monitor them. But if I can monitor them the same way at home or in the supermarket or at the movies or in Barbados, I think that's where they'd rather be than in some hospital to pick up some MRSA or disease. So I'm being flagged here. But this is my last one. So Watson IoT, we monitor bridges now. We monitor tunnels. We monitor a lot of things, and it's Watson in the background doing the actual monitoring and sending out the alerts. So those are some of the technologies, but not all, of what will impact you in the next few years. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dr. Jim King, pediatrician, Chief Medical Information Officer at CHEO. Jim, over to you.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm just going to start off with four, the presentation.
Slideshow.
I'm just going to start off with four simple things that I'd like you to think about this afternoon. The first is, are EMRs turning physicians into clinical workers? There's a great article that's just out this month in the New York Times by Dr. Verghese that discusses this. He's the professor of theory and medical practice at Stanford. The other thing to consider is medicine is inherently conservative, which adds some of the roadblocks to some of the things that you just heard about. How do we shift? And I feel like this is a bit of a Jeopardy thing. The last one is the Victorian ages. So I'll take the Victorian ages for $500. A little bit about my story and how I became involved with digital health. So the first thing is, I have to say, I work at the IBM aside, I guess. I work at the best organization, I think, in the world. If any of you haven't had an opportunity to come there or to help, to assist, to volunteer, there is nothing better than helping children get better. So that's something that I wanted to mention. I've been a pediatrician there for 30 years. I have training in epidemiology, health informatics, and healthcare system design. And I've been leading the implementation of our clinical information system. And currently, we are in the top 1% of hospitals in Canada as far as digital technologies go. So we are really leading using a well-known, more American vendor, and we are actually sharing what we are doing with other organizations. SickKids in Toronto will go live with our instance of the our EMR this Saturday. And I think that in itself will be one of the game changers as we're able to share and provide a more system level provision of care. I'd also like to say that I have no conflicts to declare. All my conflicts are internal, so nothing to. This is one of the things that has, I had an opportunity to have dinner with Bill George, who's a former CEO of Medtronic, which is like the largest developer of medical devices in the world. And he said that despite all the work they were doing with medical devices, the most important thing, and he quoted Ed Morrow, is the last 3 feet. Exchange of information electronically is a very simple thing to do, but maintaining the contact with the person in the last 3 feet is crucial. And we've done a really, really thoughtful design around our clinical information system, and I'm actually talking about that in 2 weeks' time, on June 3rd, through CAFC with a webinar, just going, giving an overview of how we designed our system so that we could actually maintain line of sight with our patients and not lose it in the having a application or a clinical decision support system actually driving what we're doing, but being complementary to what we're doing. So the actual information is provided to our patients. So I mentioned that I live in a complex, highly regulated, conservative, and paternalistic environment. So 23andMe was mentioned, right? This is the genetic counselors for North America that have a statement that says you really shouldn't use 23andMe or you shouldn't use a pharmacy genetic testing because you don't actually get the right information to put it in context with all the other things that are going on. And if people follow 23andMe, they know they actually had to change their testing. So they cannot do diagnostic testing. They can provide you information about your genetic heritage, but they can't provide you diagnostic information. And that was from FDA oversight. And this is another example of how regulated sometimes my world is. But in 1821, there was an article written that really told us that the stethoscope was the worst thing physicians could ever use, and that it would. And it took almost 70 years for people to actually really believe that the stethoscope would be safe to use with patients. But just quickly, we know that there's lots of information integration. the difficulty with this, and perhaps things like Watson will be able to help us, is we are medicalizing normal events now. When you are taking your whole data for a full day, you don't know what's really normal. And we're trying to tell people, you have to figure this out for yourself, right? And I think we need to be aware of quantum computing. We need big data, big analytics to be able to assist us in how we deal with this. Doctors are very reluctant to use data collected by patients. We're very happy to take your history, but if you provide us a flat file with a lot of data, we're not really sure what to do with it. There are economic issues behind this with self-diagnosis for sure. But there's also a culture that we're more happy to live with things that we don't know than we are with things that we do know. Because once we know something, we have to deal with it, right? So that's a bit of a challenge when you add in an extra layer of data and information. And even our best clinical information systems are unable to accept this data right now. So there are very limited ways of getting the information in. And we have an extremely robust patient health portal. So all the things that we've done in Denmark, we are currently doing in Chile. All our patients have access to our patient health portal. We cannot pull information from these devices back into our system. But I think in the future, and this is what this actual device won the 2011 Innovation Award, is we need to have something that can project for people what their state is going to be in the future. So imagine if you're collecting all this information, you get up and you look in the mirror in the morning, and it tells you what you're going to look like in 30 years' time if you keep doing what you're currently doing. I think that'll be a big motivator or driver for people to change their health. And this is another example of what Ma Bell faced back in the early 1920s with the telephone system. And I think that, again, for disruptive technologies, is something we need to think about in healthcare. But in the 20s, they projected that about 40% of the total population of the US would be required to be switchboard operators with the growth of the telephone. What they did is they actually created a rotary switch, right? A rotary dial, a packet switch that would allow you to use a rotary dial telephone, which made us all our own telephone operators. And that actually allowed Martin Cooper to develop the cell phone, and that's allowed us to get into smartphones and be able to share technology. So I think in the same way that those smart mirrors can help us, we need to be able to make each individual have the right information to be able to become their healthcare operator. And that's a big challenge, to be able to pull the right information together and have the right data analytics occurring. The other thing we need to do too is we need to make sure that the systems that we're using, so currently in that I was asking the question is, do EMRs make physicians clerks? We're very prone right now to collecting administrative data around billing. And that's a bit of a problem because on rounds in the unit, I notice our residents have their backs turned to each other, turned to the patients. They're quite happily typing in the information that the system is requiring. But what we need is the system to be able to collect that information using voice recognition, using video telegraphy, and pulling it together, and then smart things, perhaps Watson, perhaps something else, in the background, being able to provide us the information that you need and not being focused on the data collection itself. One other thing to think about is there needs to be a shift in how we educate and train people. So we're at Carleton, so I thought I'd have to bring this up, but this is the medical school that I trained at, and you can notice there are some people who are using computers. This is a fairly recent picture. This was when the school opened. I don't know if you noticed the similarities between how the future physicians are being trained. Currently, we teach people the exact same way we taught them in the 1970s, and that needs to shift a bit. And the final thing is privacy and security, and this is my comment about we're in the Victorian age around privacy. So our current health care, our current Privacy Act was written in 2004. It has not kept up with the current electronic flow of information. People expect us to be able to safely share their information. and the Health Act doesn't, FIPA, the Privacy Act, doesn't allow us to do that currently. So there has to be a major shift for us to be able to actually stay current with this. There's a new data protection that's come out from Europe recently, May 25th. That puts a lot higher expectations. But HIPAA, which is in the States and Canada, both need to be revised and need to be changed. And that's it. If anybody wants to contact me, it's very simple. I'm king@CHEO.
So Stephen Downs from the NRC is our last speaker of the day. Stephen, just sit there.
Sure, yeah, I'll just sit here. Hi, everyone. I'm Stephen Downs. I work with the National Research Council just over on Montreal Road. I used to work out in New Brunswick for a while. Moved back to Ontario a couple of years ago, and I really appreciate a good healthcare system. So thank you. I was asked to talk about blockchain, and I will talk about blockchain, but the message I would like to layer underneath the talk about blockchain is, it's first of all, a lot of this technology that is represented as really complex isn't. It's based on some fairly fundamental principles that everyone can grasp. When you grasp these principles, and you will grasp these principles, then you can see a couple of things. Most importantly, how it's easy to oversell a lot of what technology does. I've been involved in this field for a long time. I did the 1980s thing with Texas Instruments, not IBM. I currently have no associations with any tech companies. Except for my pay system, which was built by IBM. Thank you for that. And I do want to observe that, you know, we've heard and we hear, you know, such and such, like, say, privatization will make everything cheaper. And in my experience, this is very rarely, if ever, the case. And in the case of Phoenix, privatization has doubled, tripled, quadrupled the cost. And that is the normal state of affairs. When things get too expensive, the simple answers, like privatization or like technology, are almost never the solution. And so you should be resistant to them. And resistant on a knowledgeable basis. And that's what I'll attempt with blockchain for this talk. So we've already heard the story. Blockchain can be widely applied in healthcare. In addition to financial transactions, which IBM would like to bring to us, there's also electronic healthcare records, medical inventory, certification and compliance, and medical research data, among other things. And actually, you will think of more things than I will be able to think of as applications of blockchain. I'm a data person, a bits and bytes person, more than I am, far more than I am life sciences. You know, I know data and technologies and AI and online learning more than the other side of it. So what is blockchain? Always useful to know what you're talking about when somebody says it's going to sweep through the world. Blockchain is a permanent distributed consensus-based ledger. Any problem with that? Okay, let's think about that. What's a ledger? A ledger is a book of transactions. If you balance your checkbook, if you still have checkbooks, or if you use, accounting program. It used to be ACPAC, but it quickened. That's a ledger. Spreadsheet is a ledger. Ledgers are just places where you record transactions. Bill gave Fred a goat. contracts, if the goat lives, Fred will pay Bill $100. Or activities, Fred milked the goat. That's all a ledger is, right? Now, you can get complicated with a ledger, but really, at its core, it's just something for recording transactions. So that's one part of blockchain. It's a distributed consensus base. What book of stuff? Consensus. Now, consensus is a bit of a hard concept. It's harder than you might think. Let me give you an example, because everybody has a sense of what consensus means. I'm going to ask you all a question. How many of you think 4 is greater than 3? Hold up your hands. Okay. Not everybody. Okay. So, consensus doesn't even agree that 4 is greater than 3, right? So that's a problem. So let's redefine it. I'll break this room into two groups, over here and over here. On this side, how many of you think 4 is greater than 3? Fewer than last time, but still a majority. Good. On this side, how many of you think 4 is greater than 3? Oh, clear majority here. So this group agrees, this group agrees, consensus among the groups. The key here is there are different ways of creating consensus. I used a really simple algorithm to create consensus, right? There's a bunch of different ways. So consensus, broadly speaking, is a way of coming to an agreement, a mechanism for collecting the information, agreeing that the information is good, where everybody, well, or some fraction thereof, thinks it's good. In blockchain, there are different ways of coming to a consensus. Proof of work, proof of stake, authorization. Proof of work is the thing that Bitcoin does. And what that is they have the Bitcoin miner perform a long mathematical calculation. And when he's done that work, he is now in his position, or they are now in a position to put a block into the ledger, put a new line into the ledger, if you will. That's the part of Bitcoin that takes up all the energy. And right now, Bitcoin is using more energy than a small country, which is a bit of a problem. Proof of stake is a different kind of consensus where you can prove that you have, as they say, skin in the game, right? You have a stake in the outcome. Authorization is another way, and that's what we did, is authorized, because I authorized you guys to vote, I authorized you guys to vote, we had a consensus. I'm just glossing over some of this, but the main thing here is it's a way of all of us coming to agree on the contents of the ledger. Our ledger had one piece of content. 4 is greater than 3. And all of us as a group now agree that 4 is greater than 3. That's what's in our ledger. Distributed. Now what we're going to do is, instead of just having one record of 4 is greater than 3, we're going to take that same fact and distribute it to all of you. And the contrast is between that versus one big ledger owned by everybody, the single data center approach, or, as is done today, many different and separate ledgers. Right now, one company has their own ledger, another company has their own ledger, another company has their own ledger. They each put their own entries into their own ledger. The idea of one ledger, one distributed ledger, is you have all of these companies, all of these players contributing to a single ledger, and then that single ledger is shared among everybody. That single ledger is the ledger that we've already agreed on is the authoritative ledger. Make sense so far? I told you you would get this. Finally, and this is the trick, it's permanent. It's a write-only ledger. And that's where the cryptographic digital aspect of it comes into play. A blockchain is, as the name implies, a chain of blocks. And if you take one of these blocks, is or contains part of the ledger. Maybe the thing that we've just agreed on, 4 is greater than 3, right? So if you take that and you run what's called a hashing function on that, then you get an output, 27, say. And the thing is, if you change the content of the ledger, the hash is changed. So you can't change the content of the ledger. It's permanent. And where do you put the hash? You put it in the next block. And that way, each block confirms the content of the previous block. So you get a chain of blocks. So the main thing to keep in mind is through encryption, and especially through hashing, the contents of the blockchain can't be changed. That makes the contents of the blockchain authoritative. You can trust the content. If you get data from the blockchain, you can trust it because you know nobody can change it. How do you know? Because you have the hash. And if the hash doesn't match, it's been changed. The hash matches, it hasn't been changed within certain very large orders of probability. And a scientist has to say that. So there are different ways to run blockchains. The one that you're probably all familiar with is Bitcoin, right? Everybody's heard of Bitcoin, Bitcoin mania. Bitcoin's now worth $25,000. Bitcoin's now worth $5,000. Don't bet your house on Bitcoin. For goodness sakes. So Bitcoin's kind of interesting. It's an example of a public blockchain. The idea is anybody can contribute. And also with a public blockchain, the transactions are viewable by everybody. Everybody knows the history of every single Bitcoin, every single individual coin in the network. That's how we know, for example, that, what is it, about 12% of Bitcoins have been created and never spent, which is kind of interesting because they've never been transacted. That's probably not what we want in healthcare though, right? We don't want everybody seeing every transaction because we have different needs. And also, we don't want just anybody to be able to write to public healthcare blockchain. So a variety of reasons for that. Another option, including one built by IBM, Hyperledger Fabric, I'm trying to make it work right now, is a private blockchain. Private blockchain has one owner, which is great for proofs of concept and that, but there's only one user, so it's not really very useful as a blockchain. Probably what the healthcare sector and the life sciences sector is going to settle on is something like a permissioned blockchain. In a permissioned blockchain, you can have multiple people join it, multiple people who are able to write into the ledger, but you have to know who they are. It can't be just anybody. No anonymous writing into the ledger. Makes sense, right? And then access to the contents of the blockchain are protected through encryption, and so there are designated permissions, first of all, to write certain things to the blockchain, and secondly, to see certain things in the blockchain. So there would be limited access to it. But overall, when we're talking about blockchain, really what we're talking about is a big database, a big ledger. Each one of us owns a copy, or each one of us has access to a copy. This ledger is something that people write to but can't change. We can read, but since it's permission, we can only read parts of it, those parts belonging to ourselves generally, or those parts that we have authorization to access. And that's essentially blockchain. So just as an aside, kind of a significant one, when people say blockchain's going to totally reform healthcare, what they're saying is a better database system is going to reform healthcare. And I thought, are you crazy? Right? There's all kinds of other issues involved. I've done, you know, a lot of work in learning, in data management and stuff, and the biggest changes when new technology comes into play are not technological, they're social. They involve different ways of thinking. What are the requirements in life sciences? Well, let's think about this, right? Identity and authentication. You're going to have that. Anonymous contributions to, you know, information about medical inventories or personal illnesses or treatments or whatever, just not on. Permission-based, obviously. And permission-based both on a right basis, you know, only doctors can write certain information, only patients can write certain information, and also on a read basis, right? Only authorized people can read contents for individuals. It's going to be a consensus model. It's got to be a consensus model if it's going to be distributed, but it won't be based on proof of work. Mostly, well, for one thing, because there's a need for authorization, but also because proof of work is too expensive. Proof of work will ultimately doom Bitcoin because it doesn't make sense to generate that much energy just to do a transaction. Also, Bitcoin with the proof of work requirement, it's too slow. They're running at around 70 transactions per second. Compare that to the Visa network, which is running around 70,000 transactions per second. Big difference in scale, and that's what makes Bitcoin not usable. And then privacy. The records themselves, unlike in Bitcoin, the records themselves are encrypted. The identities of the people in the records themselves are encrypted. And all of this is accessible only if you have the appropriate digital key. So far, so good. This is what's going to happen. And it's going to happen because it makes a lot more, it's going to happen because it makes a lot more sense than not doing it. And then I realized, no. It's going to happen because it's cheaper, it's a lot cheaper to keep records this way. It's going to happen because it's more reliable. We will have records that we can trust, that haven't been changed, haven't been overwritten, haven't been doctored or altered. That's mostly it. But there are issues. Oh, there are always issues. You mentioned the data entry overhead, right? Writing in their notebook. I love that. People still writing in their notebooks? Yes. I'm always fascinated in 2018 to see people using a pen or a pencil and writing in a notebook, because how do you search that? I'm sorry, I shouldn't. but it's a serious problem, right? The concurrent problem that has to be solved alongside data management is data entry. And the suggestion that a lot of this stuff has to be automated makes total sense. On this, I have an application called Strava. I used to use Runkeeper, but I just changed, right? I don't run, but I do cycle a lot, and I record all of my cycling on Strava. Now, I could enter in everything manually, but I don't. I just turn it on, and then it keeps track of where I went, how fast I went, etc. That's the sort of thing, right, where we don't actually have to enter the data. We have systems that enter the data for us. Another big problem, I labeled it as Betamax versus VHS. How many of you remember Betamax versus VHS? Yeah, everybody older. There's not just one thing called blockchain, right? There are different flavors, different varieties. I mentioned, you know, private versus public versus permissioned. I talk about different kinds of consensus algorithms. There's a bunch of different things that count as blockchain. Dollars to donuts. There will be at least four major flavors, probably five major flavors of blockchain that become dominant within 10 years. One will be by IBM, one will be by Microsoft, one will be by Amazon Web Services, one will be by Apple, which doesn't work with any other kind, and one will be by Microsoft. These are also not coincidentally the major players in cloud computing data centers. Oh, and Google, I forgot Google. so that's six, right? These are also the leaders in cloud computing, data mining, AI, etc. No coincidence there. The problem is, if IBM's doesn't work with Microsoft's, doesn't work with Google's, instead of one distributed blockchain ledger, we have six. And we're right back where we started it, except instead of us owning all of our data, Amazon and Microsoft and Apple own all of our data. So that's an issue. Digital overhead, I mentioned the problem of using the proof of work algorithms, but also just the sheer computing overhead needed to run a system like this. Will we pay for it? Yes. Why? Because we cannot afford all of the paper and all of the pens that we use to keep the kind of records we can keep today. The amount of data is incredible, but we need that data. And then finally, privacy and security, major challenges. So I'm a futurist. I live 20 years in the future, which is often a problem for me in the present, but I've learned to adapt. So, what can we expect? First of all, public encrypted write-only records and also permission-based encrypted write-only records will be mainstream, period, end of story. That's how we're going to do it, because it's cheaper and faster than any other method that exists and more reliable. Secondly, we will all have digital signatures and or keys. We're almost there. In China, they use their phones. They use specifically WeChat. They pay for everything with their phone. You want to go into the Great Wall or the Forbidden City, you have to show them your WeChat thing, and they scan it. They know who you are. You can get in, or not, depending on your social index. It's kind of like the credit rating, except social. We'll all have those. We've just implemented in NRC a whole new layer of security for our computer system, and part of that is a digital key, and my computer will run only if I have a little USB thing that's keyed to me plugged into the site. That's going to be normal. That's what it's going to be. Certainly in 20 years, probably in 10. Automation of data entry, as I was mentioning before, that will be commonplace, way more than you can possibly imagine, especially by government services, etc., but also by individuals. Your house will record itself and highlight you of anything that changes. And then probably this is the least likely prediction, but seems like a good one. Multiple interconnected blockchains or interoperable blockchains. If we think of each blockchain as a network, which it kind of is, then we're going to get different networks, the Google one, the Amazon one, the Microsoft one, the Apple one that doesn't connect to anything. And we're going to connect them and we'll have an inter-network of blockchain networks. That's being discussed in the literature just now, just in the last few months. So probably that's how blockchain will evolve in the future. That's it. That's me. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
So Sal, Jim, and Stephen, thank you so much. We are way over, and going to get the hook here. But before we do that, I wonder if there is just one really important question that somebody really wants to ask before we go for drinks. No pressure.
I'm going to give you one important statement. The bar is open.
Thank you for hanging in there with us, and thank you to all the panelists, and see you at the bar.
Never let me stand between you and your liquor.